Good evening. Can everyone hear me okay? I tend to be a little soft-spoken. All right. Welcome to the inaugural forum of Sharper Focus, Wider Lens series, which provides an opportunity for the MSU community to actually highlight the expertise of our own faculty, which we believe is really important. And so we're excited to launch this. For those of you that do not know me, my name is Cynthia Jackson Elmore. I'm the Dean of the Honors College and a professor with affiliation in political science and a global urban studies program. And it's my pleasure to acknowledge our co-sponsors this evening, the Honors College, James Madison College, Muslim Studies, and the Political Science Department. I'm especially pleased to acknowledge the conceptual and intellectual leadership for bringing this series to reality and actually looking at an opportunity to be responsive to bringing an opportunity to discuss history in the making in the Middle East. And that's Professor John Beck in the back. John, if you want to, we really want to take a moment to thank him for engaging us all in this discussion. And also the behind the scenes work of Joyce Samuels and some other members of the Honors College to help launch this. One of the things I want to encourage you is to look forward to other forums in the upcoming years and the years to come. I'm going to ask you to sit back, well actually maybe ask you to sit on the edge of your seats as we begin the dialogue about the upheaval in the Middle East and North Africa and talk about context, consequences, and implications. I'm going to turn to my colleague, Dr. Mohammed Ayoub, who is a University Distinguished Professor of International Relations, affiliated with James Madison College in the Department of Political Science, and he specializes in research on civil and international conflict.
Thank you, Cynthia, for that introduction. What I intend to do this evening, well, I should probably get hold of this. What I intend to do this evening and use the 10 minutes that we have, each one of us has at our disposal, is to basically lay out some of the important issues that we need to discuss. I'll, of course, make my own comments as I go along about these issues, but then I'll leave it to the rest of the panel to deal with these issues in greater detail and greater depth. The first thing, when these upheavals started in Tunisia first and then spread throughout much of North Africa and now into the Arab heartland, the Arab East as well, with Syria and into the Gulf, what struck me most was the unanticipated nature of these upheavals. These were upheavals that should have been anticipated, particularly by the community of scholars and policy analysts engaged in studying the Middle East, but everyone, including all the pundits, were caught by surprise. And this is an indication of how little the professional commentators on the Middle East, myself included, know of what is actually taking place in the Middle East, particularly at the popular level. It was not only the Obama administration that was playing catch-up as events unfolded. Experts on the Middle East were trying to do the same. So there was very little understanding. There was that what was happening at the level of popular aspirations. There was very little understanding of what was really going on. There was a disparaging attitude towards what was called the Arab Street. The term Arab Street had in fact become a derogatory term that analysts in the West particularly used. I have refused to use that term. I always call it the Arab public or the Arab publics in the plural. But this indicates of how little we knew what was going on. The events in the Middle East, I'm sure my colleagues will expand on these, expand on this in greater detail. The events in the Middle East have exploded two myths. One, the myth of Arab exceptionalism when it came to democratization. People were used until recently to refer to this, to the lack of democracy in the Arab world, as Islamic exceptionalism. And I used to always correct them by telling them that this is not an Islamic exceptionalism. Two-thirds or more of the Muslims around the world live under one sort of democratic system or another, even if some of them may be far from perfect. It was really an Arab exception. rather than a Muslim exception. And let me remind you once more that only 20% of the Muslims around the world are Arabs. But this, what's been happening in the last few months in the Middle East, also explodes this myth of Arab exceptionalism. And second, it also explodes the myth that Islamist movements and parties are the only alternatives to pro-Western dictatorships. The common people in Arab countries have demonstrated that their political and economic aspirations were no different from those of common people elsewhere, that they wanted dignity and freedom on the one hand and food and jobs on the other. Very, very secular concerns. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't Islamist movements in the mix of the democratic upsurge of the democratic movements that we have seen. But I think it has cut down the Islamist movements to size. Now we know that there was this feeling that they are larger than life size, and if these dictators fall, all hell is going to break loose because Islamic extremists are going to take over. That myth has been, I think, buried forever. The third thing that impressed me about these upheavals was the peaceful nature of the democracy movements. In Tunisia, in Egypt, in Bahrain, even in Yemen, where almost everyone is armed. And initially in Libya, until the massive violence unleashed by the Gaddafi regime changed the complexion of the Libyan struggle and turned it into a virtual civil war. The peaceful nature of these movements was startling, because usually the Middle East at least some of the public discourse is equated with violence, terrorism, and so on and so forth. It appeared that the democracy movements had learned the lesson that violence breeds counter-violence, and that while the demonstrators could not compete with the regimes in terms of instruments of violence, they could paralyze these regimes by massive civil disobedience. And I wondered whether Gandhi must have been chuckling in heaven while witnessing this information age rerun of the civil disobedience and non-cooperation movements that he helped lead India in the 1920s and 30s. I mean, many of these movements were almost Gandhian in character. The fourth thing that comes to mind when watching what was going on in the Middle East is that the United States administration, was slow to throw its support behind the democracy movements in the Middle East, because it was concerned that its strategic interests, that American strategic interests, would be compromised, since the United States had for long depended upon Arab dictators and monarchs to protect these interests. Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, and Joe Biden, the Vice President, in their public statements, continued to show support for Mubarak until very late in the game. Biden went to the extent of declaring that Mubarak was no dictator. Even when Washington began to shift its stance, it did so selectively. Democracy is good for Libya and now perhaps for Syria, but certainly not for Bahrain. The application of these double standards, I'm sure, has not gone unnoticed among the Arab peoples. As I watched these events unfold, it occurred to me that the two most despicable acts of this unfolding drama were, one, the use of massive violence by the Gaddafi regime against the Libyan people demanding freedom, and two, the Saudi-led GCC military intervention in Bahrain to stiffen the resolve of the Bahraini ruling house to confront the democracy movement by massive force, and not to make any concessions that may set a precedent for other Gulf monarchies. In a truly Orwellian move, the Saudi regime supports the removal of Gaddafi while shoring up the Bahraini monarchy, and no Western leader has had the courage to point out this contradiction to the House of Saud. What the Bahraini establishment and the Saudi friend and its Saudi friends have achieved by portraying the democracy movement in Bahrain as a Shia-Sunni conflict is to turn it into a self-fulfilling prophecy. The sectarian divide that was rendered salient in Iraq by American intervention has been exacerbated in Bahrain by Saudi intervention. And just as in Iraq, it will end up benefiting Iran, which has had long historical connections not only with Bahrain, but also with peoples in all the countries of the Arab Gulf. Finally, democracy movements in the Arab world have raised a major uncomfortable question for Washington, and one that is bound to be asked around the Arab world once the dust settles on the current upheavals. If the United States is for freedom and democracy in the Arab world, why does it make an exception of Palestine that continues to suffer from not only from lack of democracy, but indeed from continued occupation and colonization? I've attempted to raise some of the salient issues that come to mind when analyzing the current upheavals in the Arab world in the hope that my colleagues will find answers to these questions. Thank you.
And now we're going to have Dr. Ani Sarkinson, who's an assistant professor in political science, offer some historical context.
Thank you. How's the volume? In recent weeks, I've read many analyses comparing what's going on in North Africa and the Middle East, to revolutions occurring in 1848, 1968, 1989, and 2000 to 2005. I'm going to focus my brief remarks on comparing the Arab upheavals to the revolutions that brought down communist rule in Eastern Europe and Eurasia, and later revolts in the post-communist republics, the so-called color revolutions, and to outlining lessons that the Arab states can perhaps learn from these countries as they engage in regime transition and democratization. And as I look around the room, I realize many of you do not remember the 1989 and revolutions, and so some of this might be a history lesson. But I think it's an interesting comparison and important to think about. So one big similarity in the 1989 revolutions to the Arab ones is the snowball effect, with revolt in one country leading to revolt in another until the entire region is affected. Some have even referred to what is occurring in the Arab world as the fourth wave of democratization. While this may eventually end up being the case, I think it's too early to make such a determination, and perhaps even to be able to label the upheavals in North Africa and the Middle East as revolutions as of yet. The revolutions that took place in Eastern Europe in 1989 accomplished several huge feats, which include sparking a series of revolutions later throughout the Soviet bloc, undoing the command economy system, dismantling the Soviet and communist empire, and delegitimizing the communist ideology. It's yet to be seen whether the revolts in the Arab countries will succeed in such a major overhaul of political and economic systems in the Middle East. On the one hand, the mass nature of the protests and their quick spread suggests that the people of the region are ready for a change and are willing to accept it. On the other hand, there are some important differences between the 1989 to 91 revolutions in Eastern Europe and Eurasia and the Arab cases. So first, I'd like to talk about what we can learn from these revolutions. The first thing to note is that the most successful transitions from the 1989 revolutions were in places where mass protests began the transition. So countries such as the Czech Republic, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Slovenia. These protests were important to the success of the transition because they signaled the breakdown of the authoritarian regime. They created a large opposition that was united by its resistance to authoritarian leaders. And they created a mandate for change that allowed the first competitive elections to give a large victory for democratic forces, which was followed by significant economic and political reforms. That is, these were successful revolutions because they made a clean break with the past, excluding the military from political influence, excluding leaders associated with the prior regime, and initiating major changes in the economy quickly. Some have also suggested that previous experience with multi-party democracy in Eastern Europe before the imposition of communism gave some countries an advantage in democratization, which has some differences with the Arab countries, but that's a contested claim. But the mass nature of the North African and Middle Eastern protests and the insistence on deposing the authoritarian leaders rather than negotiating with them is similar to these prior revolutions and suggests a possible positive outcome. What remains to be seen is what role the military will play in the subsequent transitions and how quickly and deeply economic reforms will be embarked upon. The 1989 revolutions teach us that without quick and major economic changes and civilian control over the military, democracy will not have a great likelihood of success. Yet it's also important to remember that not all of the countries that emerged out of the downfall of communism are democratic today. One pattern we've observed is that in those countries where former communists won the first competitive elections, it was more likely that authoritarian rule would continue. This includes countries such as Georgia, Ukraine, and the republics of Central Asia, among others. These and other new post-communist republics embarked upon the process of democratic transition, but failed to achieve the successes of their Eastern European contemporaries. In some countries, this sparked a new series of revolutions referred to as the color revolutions from 2000 to 2005, including ones in Serbia in 2000, Ukraine in 2004, Georgia in 2003, and Kyrgyzstan in 2005. The point to underscore here is that it might be easier to overthrow dictators than to establish democracy. The color revolutions were internally oriented, causing people to question how their own leaders had failed them. These examples show how difficult it can be to develop democracy once you throw the bums out, and also point to important preconditions for the success of democracy that we should consider in the case of the Arab countries. Keeping in mind that every country is unique, I'd like to discuss some common characteristics of the color revolutions and how they compare to the Arab upheavals. I just have a few that I'd like to go through quickly. First, underscoring Mohammed's point, nonviolence characterized the strategy of the color revolutions in Georgia, Ukraine, and Serbia, which forced the regimes to refrain from using violence against them. Now, this was not the case in Kyrgyzstan, and we saw violence happening there. This was mostly the case, as we've seen, in Egypt and Tunisia as well. And they have also, so far, been successful in ousting their leaders and embarking on this transition process. So what this example suggests to us is that where we see regimes responding to protests with violence, we should be less likely to see successful transitions occurring. Second, the militaries in the post-communist countries were weak or did not participate in revolutions and subsequent transitions. In many of the Arab countries, the militaries are stronger and do have the potential to play a role. We know from previous transitions in places like Latin America that this strength can allow these actors to negotiate a stronger position for themselves in the immediate post-transition government, but that does not necessarily mean that their strength will endure in the long term. So it's not clear that having the military play an immediate role dooms these countries to failure in the long term. Third, the color revolutions followed fraudulent elections by semi-authoritarian leaders. The Arab upheavals did not follow elections, although they did reflect dissatisfaction with authoritarian leaders who had achieved power through flawed elections and had hindered any sort of democratic progress. Moreover, in the color revolutions, there was dissatisfaction with the pace of progress towards market reforms and anger at economic corruption among elites. The Arab revolts appear to be similar in that they also reflect anger at both political and economic corruption, though the extent of the reforms demanded in some of these countries seems to exceed those demanded during the color revolutions and suggests perhaps a more difficult transition to come. Fourth, organized youth movements played an important role in the color revolutions. We saw that in the current revolts, youth have also played an important role, for instance, the April 6th movement in Egypt, but that they were accompanied by people from all segments of society. This reflects the deepness of the dissatisfaction within the Arab regimes and the need to reform all sectors of society, again, pointing to the larger scale of the change that will have to come in the Arab countries. Fifth, the color revolutions had some degree of prior organization by young people, but they also had individuals who led them who had prior experience in government. For instance, Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia had been justice minister, and Viktor Yushchenko had been Ukraine's prime minister before the Orange Revolution there. This allowed elections to proceed quickly and the political situation to stabilize in a shorter amount of time. This differs greatly from the Arab revolts, which do not coalesce around a leader or opposition party and seem to leave no role for the old elites in the regimes that are to be created. This may end up working to the benefit of Arab countries, though it does leave open the question of who is qualified to participate in the multi-party elections and lead the country, and how long it will take for politics in these countries to stabilize. So to summarize, I think that there are two main lessons we can learn from the revolutions that occurred in Eastern Europe and Eurasia to help us think about what lies in the future for the countries in North Africa and the Middle East. First, overthrowing a dictator doesn't mean you've changed the system. In Ukraine, former communists ruled the country until the Orange Revolution initially deposed them, but subsequent elections brought back the old guard. In Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili's government has proven to be a disappointment to those who expected Western-style pluralism once the former communist Edvard Shevardnadze was deposed by the Rose Revolution. And Kyrgyzstan, which was initially predicted to be the Central Asian republic with the most potential for democracy, which is not that unlike how Egypt is spoken of today, ended up being a huge disappointment as corruption and nepotism took hold first under former communist President Akayev, and as his successor from the Tulip Revolution, Bakiyev, failed to restore free elections and civil liberties. So these examples show that even self-styled reformist elites may not live up to democratic expectations. Second, political and economic change must occur together, and they may result in difficult times initially. Support from neighbors and international actors can help countries weather the storms caused by these upheavals, but there is also the potential for reforms to backslide. Moreover, the development of a middle class is important, as the middle class demands rights and the rule of law. Now, I've been talking a lot in negative terms and things that the Arab countries need to fear and be careful of as they go forward. I'd like to very briefly, in my final remarks, address the fear of religious involvement in the transition and consolidation of democracy. One thing I'd like us to remember is that the Catholic Church played an important role in democratic transitions in Latin America and in Eastern Europe, notably in Poland and Lithuania. Liberation theology was important in cementing the social justice message of the church and getting it involved with labor and human rights movements in these countries. So there's no reason for us to believe that Islam cannot play a similar role in the Middle East by helping to draw people's attention to the fundamental injustices that are occurring in the region and using the religion's organizational resources to help advance democratic causes. Many people have focused on the Muslim Brotherhood and the role that they'll play in Egypt's transition. We see that while they took a backseat during the revolution, they appear to have more influence and involvement now. And reports indicate that they are dealing directly with the army to decide the future of the country. As they're the most organized of the opposition groups in the country, it makes sense that they would be involved. However, this has people questioning what direction the country would take if they won elections. They backed the recently passed constitutional amendments that create an accelerated election schedule, which some say means that they recognize and seek to exploit their advantage as an already organized movement compared to secular, liberal, and other forces in the country. But this still remains to be seen. There's also an update today that opposition movements succeeded in convincing or changing the, pushing back the election date so that they have more time to organize. But one thing I like to point to is that there's evidence to show that Islamic parties have not had much relative success in countries where they compete in fair elections. So if we take other Muslim countries as examples, we should perhaps not be so fearful of Islamic parties participating in elections as long as they are competitive. That is, as long as we can establish free and fair elections, we should not be fearful of these parties. However, religious, ethnic, and tribal differences are quite important in other countries, for example, Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, and Libya. So we should not dismiss the potential for these issues to become more salient as the upheavals continue. These issues were used by autocratic leaders to derail the progress of democratic transition in several of the post-communist republics, and we should not be surprised to see them used to derail transitions in the Arab countries as well.
Thank you, Ani, and I appreciate Mayoub Mohammed and Ani setting the stage for us. And now I'd like to invite our other panelists to join the discussion. We're going to start with Dr. Najib Hourani, who is an assistant professor in anthropology with an affiliation in global urban studies, and he's concerned with post-conflict reconstruction and heritage preservation, and also looks at issues of anthropology of the Arab world.
Thank you very much. That's my understanding. I don't have to speak directly into this, right? We're good? Okay. That was a humbling presentation in its clarity and focus. I'm going to be a little bit more loose in my presentation this evening. Part of the reason why I feel like I have to be a little bit loose is because there's just so much going on, right? The challenge of trying to think about such a momentous wave of transformation cascading really across a number of different countries, different social, political, economic contexts, really makes the mind a little bit weak. But I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to think about these things because, as Mohammed said with his introduction, what's been going on over the last couple of months has gone a long way to overturn conventional wisdom as brought to the American people by politicians, pundits, newscasters, and other experts on the Middle East. It's confounded conventional wisdom insofar as the exceptionalism that has been attributed to the Arab world, right? The Arab world consistently understood as that region which lacks the characteristics or traits that make the West civilized, right? Those traits that we consider to be the hallmark of our own civilization, we believe for a long time, or we have believed for a long time, are absent in the Middle East, right? So these uprisings have been motivated by those values that we consider the hallmarks of our own civilization: patriotism, secularism, human freedom, right? A focus on human dignity, rooted first and foremost in the idea that all human beings have a certain set of economic rights as well as political rights. If there's one thing that I would encourage people to think about going forward is the degree to which even today much of the media coverage that we are getting, much of the analysis that we are getting about the transformations in the region focus on certain pre-approved theoretical frames, if you will, right? There is the discussion of political freedom, right? They have come to want democracy, as if they hadn't before wanted democracy, as if democracy was somehow a foreign term. There's also the women question. Understanding, well, if you look at most of the coverage, you'll see that women tend to be excluded from the coverage or presented as helpers, right? They participated in the revolts, or they supported the revolts in certain ways, rather than giving them the sort of central role that they've played. By and large, however, the question of economic rights, the question of economic grievance and economic motivations in these rebellions and uprisings across the region has been left to the side, especially in the case of Egypt. Right? After Mubarak stepped down, much of the media seemed to accept that democracy would be coming. It might be a more or less rocky road, but there would be democracy, leaving to the side the fact that there were continuous protests going on throughout Cairo and all of the secondary cities of Egypt, specifically about labor rights, the right to unionize, the right to organize, the right to strike, the right for better wages, better working conditions, all the same things that your grandparents, my grandparents, and their parents before them fought for in the United States. But that has not been a part of the media story, right? Or even many of the more intelligent analyses have left that kind of economic dimension to the side. So that's something that I want to bring to the forefront. And I think the best way to do that is to return the Arab world, if it will, to the global community from which it's so often excluded, is to talk about the history a little bit, in a slightly different way than Ani has just done. And I want to start by noting the tens of thousands of people that have been protesting in Wisconsin, right? I want to note for you another story that just in this last week that I did not hear about on any of the major network news, and that was 500,000 people in the streets of London just a couple days ago, protesting against the austerity measures that the government is putting in place as a result of financial crises, not unlike the financial crises or stemming from those that came from the United States. Los Angeles, just a couple days ago, tens of thousands, right, protesting in the streets. Ohio, just last month, right? These uprisings, if you will, in the United States have been matched by uprisings in other countries, right? Not in the Middle East. Greece, right? Portugal, Iceland. And that poster child of good free market economics, Ireland, which is now back in the doldrums, right? All of these countries have experienced tremendous popular uprisings of late that we tend not to think of in the same kind of vein, but I think they can be and should be connected. These things we think of as unique and new, powerful, when we talk about them in the Western context. But they're not anything new for the Arab world. And this is something to keep in mind. The same policies that have brought you these sudden protests in the United States, in Europe, and so forth, have been ongoing policies in the Arab world for the past 30 years, right? So this rush to austerity, to cutting budgets, to repressing labor, to cutting education, healthcare, et cetera, that is shaking American politics today has been an ongoing experience in the Arab world in the name of neoliberalization, in the name of integrating the Arab world into processes of globalization, right? As these processes have been ongoing, so too have the crises. So too have the crises that we consider to be new here, right? In Egypt, for example, after many years of neoliberalization, of free market reforms, unemployment reaches 45%, right? GDP does not grow, economic growth does not take place, job opportunities are not being produced. What is being produced, as some would argue is the case in the United States today, is an increasing separation between an increasingly small, very wealthy elite and an increasingly large and impoverished population, right? The disparity in income and economic opportunity and in wealth in Egypt is tremendous. Second place, Jordan, the exact same thing takes place since the 1980s forward, mid-80s forward. With successive attempts to marketize everything, right? Withdraw the state, create business-friendly environments, et cetera, with the exact same results that we were seeing in Egypt and we see elsewhere, right? So in the Arab world, the past 40 years is a history of constant and deepening marketization of everything, right? That is increasing polarity, decreasing opportunities, and as necessity, increasing repression, right? You cannot sustain these transformations over 40 years without increasing repression across the Middle East. And so you see, even in once liberal and relatively democratic Lebanon, right, the same kinds of things taking place throughout the 1990s. Labor repression, monitoring of media, silencing of critics, et cetera, all in the name of increasing integration with global capitalism, right? But to simply credit free market ideology, right, the neoliberalism with destroying Arab economies over the last 30, 40 years, and increasing repression within the Arab world over the last 30 and 40 years, isn't really sufficient. What needs to be kept in mind, and I think this gets to some of the discussions that we're going to have as the evening goes on, is the degree to which the Western countries, the United States, the European countries, and the institutions that have pushed globalization, marketization, I'm talking about the World Bank, the IMF, and indeed even the United Nations in many ways, have relied upon decidedly illiberal forces to implement liberalization policies, right? So in the name of free markets, they have relied upon oligarchs. In the name of increasing freedom, they have relied upon dictators. The classic example of this would be, well, Mubarak, for one, right? Who was very keen upon implementing these free market reforms. And as we know, he came away, when he stepped down, he had 40 billion stashed in, not surprisingly, Western banks, right? Those who surround the Jordanian royal family, right? The same thing. You can actually talk about many of these countries in ways that we used to talk about Central American dictatorships, right? Indeed, in El Salvador, they used to talk about the 14 families. You heard about that? The 14 families that used to control the El Salvadoran economy. There was a similar number for Guatemala, a similar number for Nicaragua. Well, in Jordan, it's about 14 families, maybe 16. In Lebanon, it's less, right? And in Egypt, we can see the same pattern. So what we have relied on in the name of liberalization, political liberalization, economic, has been the opposite, right? We have relied upon dictators and oligarchs to put those policies in place, to maintain those policies, and to engage in the repression required to keep the people in line. How am I doing on time?
You're close.
I'm close? Okay. I'm sorry? Am I close as in done close? Oh. I'm done. Well, let me just then leave you with one thought to bring it sort of back to the beginning, in which the Arab world was defined by those Western traits that it lacks, right? Lack of freedom, lack of entrepreneurial spirit, lack of whatever. And I'd like you to think about that in terms of Eastern Europe, actually. And think about that in terms of the dictatorships of Central America from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and the kinds of apparatuses that were required to keep people in such instances of inequality down, right? In my time in Jordan, I made the mistake of engaging in political conversation in a pizza parlor, right? And the look of terror on my host's face as I said something negative about the king in Pizza Hut, right, underscores the degree to which the mechanisms of control that separate people, that separate families, that separate tribes and groups into peoples that cannot trust one another, right, I think goes a long way to explaining or to helping us to understand the kinds of polities that are now suddenly being overthrown. While those are very effective means of control, they can also be very, very brittle. And we're seeing that brittleness today. And I'm sorry, I took too long, but thank you for bearing with me.
Thank you very much, Najib. And now we would like to hear from Wasim El-Reyes, Dr. Wasim El-Reyes, who is an assistant professor in James Madison College. And his research interests include Islamic political philosophy as well as modern political thought in the Muslim world.
Thank you. My comments will be much briefer, and it will be, sorry, that's why it's okay with when Najib's taking a little bit of time. There are two things that I would like to be in response to some of the things that have been mentioned here. One of the things that Professor Ayoub, for example, raised is the question of the myth of Arab exceptionalism. In fact, this is how I wanted to begin my comments, and it's in response that you have raised in the pre-planning for this panel. Do the democratic movements in the Middle East explode the myth that Muslim countries are not ready for democracy because there is an inherent tension between Islam and democracy? My first impression, looking at that question, was in the positive. Looking at how events in Tunisia and Egypt has been received on the popular level and also by major media outlets, with the exception of one, gave me, people looking at what's happening in a place like Egypt, people demanding peacefully their rights, the men, women, Muslims, Christians, secular, rich and poor, old and young, coming day after day, demanding their rights, refusing to be intimidated by Mubarak's goons and Bin Ali's thugs. I think that was such a powerful impression, and people saw in these images, recognized common humanity. But giving a second thought, I thought that perhaps I shouldn't be too quick in being that optimistic. And thinking about this myth, that this myth itself serves a purpose. It serves a purpose especially for the autocratic regimes that rules the Arab countries. If Islam is incompatible with democracy, then you cannot trust Muslims and Arabs to rule themselves. And therefore, you should not push too much for human rights and democratization in the region. So it serves the purpose of a regime. And in order to defeat, I think that the defeat of that myth depends on what would happens in Tunisia and Egypt especially. And I think Annie is right in pointing out that we don't yet know what is the possibility of how successful the movement to democracy will be in Egypt. It depends on what happens in Tunisia and Egypt. If they are successful in transitioning to democracy, I think that myth will cease to be effective. There are good signs, I think, that at least make me optimistic about the possibility of a good transition. And this is the incredible political maturity that the young activists and also old activists, and both male and female, showed in these movements. It was not the events, the movement in Egypt and Tunisia was not only directed or focused on the head of the regime. It demanded the downfall of the regime. So when Bin Ali in Tunisia left, that was not enough for the Tunisians. When Mubarak left, that was not enough for the Egyptians, and they demanded that his prime minister, Ahmed Shafiq, vice president, Omar Sliman, also to be removed. And there was resistance And some people said, you know, like, let's give the regime a chance to fix the country. But there was critical mass in the street that said no. And they were successful. Omar Suleiman had to go. But they were not satisfied with the prime minister who was appointed by Mubarak. And they demanded, and again, debates of people, you know, enough, Ahmed Shafiq is a nice guy. You know, give him a chance. And they refused. You know, they understand that it is about the regime. And it's still going on in Egypt and in Tunisia. And in Tunisia, there is also incredible success with respect to questions regarding the state security. The Egyptians are not as successful in removing the state security from the picture. Just to follow what Annie have said, you know, there are still some signs also that makes me, you know, not as optimistic. And the fact, and this is the fact that the military is still in control, and the military, as Professor Ayoub had pointed before, is heavily invested in the regime, and it's not really interested in genuine reform. At least the top brass. And there are many signs which actually doesn't make it, I think, to the news these days about that makes one worried. They have been abusive. They have been implicated in torture after the fall of the regime. So they did not prove themselves to be the protector of the people fully as the people wished them to be. But the demonstrators in the streets still want to give the army a chance. They want elections, but they want the elections to be delayed. And I'm glad I didn't hear that they decided. I hope they will give it enough time. That the elections will be held will give opposition parties enough time, especially those who are marginalized during Mubarak's regime, enough time to mobilize and be able to run a competitive election. An immediate election would benefit, that's what people expect, would benefit the old party, which probably would run in with a different name, the governing party, and also some of the Muslim Brotherhood. But what's interesting about the Muslim Brotherhood is it doesn't, at least, you know, following some of the events in Egypt, it's not interested in running in a competitive election where they will, take over all of the seats. There is talk, for example, that they would run, I don't know, 30% or 40% of the seat. That's where they would run competitive elections. So there is, you know, I think the Muslim Brotherhood itself is aware that there are fears, especially from those who are outside, about their power, and they do not want to give these fears, more fire. So the military is still in control. There's some worrying signs about that, I agree with much that Annie have said and Najib, especially with respect to the exceptionalism question. The absence. There is another question, Dr. Ayoub, that you also sent, and that links with this, which is the. You know, what does the absence of Islam as a major driving force for the anti-regime movement tell us about the common assumption in the West that the fall of pro-Western autocracies would lead to Islamist movements taking power in the Arab world? I think the absence of Islam as a major driving force is a proof, at the very least, that the failure of Islamist movements to to be able to mobilize the society as a whole. I don't think the Muslim Brotherhood would have been possible, would have been able in Tunisia or in Egypt to appeal to you know, Muslims, Christians, secularists, men, women, in the, even though there are, you know, like Muslim Brothers had different, it wasn't, part of it was involved in the demonstrations. So that, I think, also is yet another clue about the how we could look at the question of the myth of Islam and democracy. I think that would be for me here. I'll stop here, and maybe in the question and answer we can deal more.
Thank you very much. And now we'll hear from Dr. Yael Aronoff, who is the Michael and Elaine Serling and Friends Chair of Israel Studies in James Madison College.
Thanks so much. And I'm also an assistant professor of international relations, so I'm a political scientist who comes from kind of that kind of perspective on things as well that I'll share with you. So first of all, I just wanted to kind of welcome you here, and it's such a pleasure to be here. It's such an exciting time. I think we're all of us are rooting like crazy for the democratization demands in all of these countries, and hope very much that they'll be successful and thriving and healthy democracies. So it's a very exciting time to be discussing this, even though, of course, there are a lot of obstacles remaining that have been brought up. I think I'd like to talk about three things. One is kind of looking at the conditions that make democratization ripe and that make it more likely to develop into a healthy democracy, and look at the different circumstances in some of these countries and compare them on that basis. And some of the comparisons have already been made in terms of the role of the military and perhaps the role of economics in this. And then secondly, I'd like to look in political science and in international relations. We have something called the democratic peace theory. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with it. It's kind of a bipartisan notion in the United States that democracies don't fight each other, which is even more reason why we should get really excited about democratization, other than, of course, the calls for human rights and dignity and freedom that everyone deserves around the world. So I'd like to kind of play out what this may mean in terms of the democratic peace theory in the region. And thirdly, again, as kind of coming from an international relations perspective, I'd like to look at the effects this might have on the balance of power in the region as a whole, beyond the precise looking at the individual circumstances for democracy in each country. So I'll try to do all those things really quickly. In terms of conditions for democratization, it's kind of interesting to also look around the region and see, on one hand, it's been this amazing kind of inspirational domino theory, domino effect, that each country gets inspired by demonstrations in another country, and it just seems to be sweeping across the region. On the other hand, it's also kind of interesting to step back for a moment and say, okay, are there countries where this isn't happening, and why not, right? So certainly it seems like a lot of the Gulf countries that either, as Professor Ayoub suggested, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that kind of supported, went in to step in and bring 2,000 troops in to support the Bahrain regime, and are also participating in the Qatar and the United Arab Emirates are in the, international no-fly zone and other things in Libya. A lot of those countries in the Gulf don't seem to be facing many demonstrations, right? And so the question there may be, why not other than Bahrain, right? And so, of course, I think a lot of you that are knowledgeable about the Middle East, and a lot of you in the audience I know certainly are, and we're students here who are experts themselves almost on the Middle East. But of course, we have the phenomenon of the rentier states in a lot of these Gulf countries, which actually the Human Development Index is extremely high. They're doing very well economically, at least for the citizens, which in some of the countries are actually a minority of the people living in these countries. But they're able to not depend, because of the huge oil revenues on which the government's GMP is dependent, they're able to continue to govern without necessarily relying on the demands of the people, because they're not really taxed. So one theory goes that is that if you're taxed, you're going to be making more demands upon your government as to how those taxes are going to be distributed and what's going to be done with it. And a lot of these countries that have a tremendous amount of oil in the Gulf, they're able to, you know, provide actually for the healthcare and education and all these other things for the citizenry. And so there's less, perhaps, a demand or resentment, or deep, as deep a resentment perhaps against the government might be one argument. And a second argument is because a lot of the jobs and a lot of things are so dependent upon the state that there's no kind of independent middle class or independent body that would even be able to effectively challenge the regime if they wanted. So both Professor Arias and I are teaching Vali Nasser's Islamic Capitalism in one of our classes this semester, and they're making kind of a different kind of argument that actually neoliberalism can foster kind of this independent middle class. And I think it depends on each country, and it depends, you know, I'm kind of hesitant to make universal statements about this across the region, but you do have a lot of countries here in which you don't see massive demonstrations, and perhaps because they're kind of in a different category. And that's a good thing to kind of keep in mind as we assess kind of how far this will go in the region and how quickly. And certainly, as many of you know, Saudi Arabia in the last month offered an extra, I don't know whether it was $30 billion or I don't know, to its citizens to kind of, in a way, perhaps pay them off, right, so that they won't demonstrate as much. So that's certainly one kind of obstacle to democratization, not an insurmountable obstacle, but one obstacle to democratization in some of the Gulf region states. So you'd ask, okay, well, what about Bahrain? Why is Bahrain one of the only countries in which you do have all these protests? And so that, therefore, it forces you to look at other conditions that in combination may produce demonstrations. And certainly, as many of you know, in Bahrain's case, you have a minority Sunni government, right, ruling over a majority Shiite population. And that confluence perhaps exacerbates the resentments and tensions against that regime in that country, which is maybe unlike the situation in some of the other Gulf countries. And I think another thing to look at in some of these other countries is, again, the role of the military, the role of external influence, the role of economics, perhaps, the role of to what extent the government has a history of it being able to deal with repressing demonstrations and so forth. So again, if you look at the several countries around, as has been noted, the military in Tunisia and Egypt didn't really, they kind of allowed, to some extent, right, the demonstrations to occur and the reforms to occur. In other countries, and although, as Professor Arias correctly points out, they may be so strong that it's at one point it may interfere with real democracy. But in other countries, like if you look at Syria right now, which has been in the news for the past week, where, right, where you have now growing demonstrations in Syria, on one hand, you can also look at, like the Bahrain case, you have a confluence of not only a repressive regime, but again, a minority ethnicity ruling a majority, right? So you have the Alawites, which are about 10% of the Syrian population, ruling a majority, so around 75% Sunni, at least 10% Kurds and others, right? So that on one hand, can kind of increase the resentment and the tensions in the country against the regime. But on the other hand, in the Syrian case, you would think that we might face even bigger obstacles in Syria in terms of Assad being ousted, because if he loses power, he loses power completely, right? And we could look at Iraq in this case, where you had a Sunni minority ruling over a Shiite majority, right? No matter how you slice it, and we could have handled it much better in Iraq, you know, once you even make a decision to go, in terms of not robbing Sunni so completely of their power as we did in Iraq. But no matter how you slice it, if you have real democracy in Iraq, the Sunnis are gonna lose big time. And you have the same thing happening in Syria, which the Alawites are entrenched in the government and entrenched in the military. It's even going to be harder for him to let go, because if there is a democracy in Syria, the Alawites are out, representing 10% of the population, right? I mean, it's not just sharing power, it's losing power almost completely, right, in this sense. On the other hand, he has so entrenched the military with fellow Alawites in different levels, that again, if you look at the military's role in Syria, it might be a different situation perhaps than in Egypt and Tunisia, and they maybe will wait and see supporting the government to a greater extent. So you have a kind of different situation in Syria. You can also look at Iran. We haven't really mentioned that we had demonstrations in Iran. Of course, we had massive demonstrations in Iran in 2009 as well. And the government repressed those completely and put the opposition leaders under house arrest. Some people claim that they actually were jailed. So they were repressed. So why were they successful in Iran? Well, there's a combination of reasons, and we're kind of simplifying everything in our 10-minute you know, summaries, but one could say, well, they already had a history, the government, of this wasn't new to them, that they weren't sure how to react and didn't know what to do, but they had faced previous demonstrations in many years and had already kind of had a better system for repressing the demonstrations, unfortunately. Now, it's a really kind of good question that was brought up. Do you have a greater sense of demonstrations happening in the most repressive countries, or perhaps in the countries that have already opened up a little bit? Because you do have some opening in Iran in terms of presidential elections, of course, even though it's still rigged. In many ways. You had some opening in Egypt in terms of efforts at reform with the parliament, some efforts at reform in Jordan. They were certainly marred with lots of setbacks, but in those cases, perhaps with Egypt and Jordan, one could act that it's actually the openings that created, allowed opposition forces to organize and increased expectations, and possibly even in Iran as well. Whereas maybe in the most repressive states, one could arguably say, I don't know, you could maybe look at Saudi Arabia, maybe look at Syria, it's become belatedly and hasn't been as strong, and it's kind of interesting to see, you know, what will happen. And then, of course, you have to look at the external influences. So you could arguably say that the international, now NATO, intervention in Libya is opening up the space possibly for democratization in Libya, where the Saudi and UAE efforts in Bahrain are constraining those choices. And by the way, it seemed like the US was pretty angry with the Saudis for surprising them, and Bahrain for surprising them. Hillary had just been in the country. They had just talked with the Saudis, were strong allies, just given $60 billion of military aid to Saudi Arabia, and we completely were blindsided by the forces apparently going into Bahrain. So this is certainly not something that Obama was welcoming or urging. Rather, he was calling for reform, and he was calling for reform there and in Yemen in a more slow fashion that he was calling for in other countries, and we can talk about that in a little bit. So secondly, and also you can look at the different models and attempts at democratization in the Middle East. You can look at Israel, Lebanon, the Palestinian Authority, Turkey. And so one of the things you can look at as inhibiting democratization might be if there's no centralized kind of legitimate use of force and you have independent militias, as you might have arguably delayed, hampered, weakened democratization efforts in Lebanon and among and within the Palestinian territories. Secondly, if you look at the democratic peace, I think here again there's a lot to celebrate in terms of hopefully democracies getting established around the Middle East. Certainly, the democratic peace, which suggests therefore you're going to have even more peace in the region among fellow democracies, and arguably there are a lot of reasons that could substantiate this as the publics actually grow to support certain peace agreements. There's more behind it, there's more support for it, they could be stronger and more long-standing. Certainly there's a lot of opposition figures in Egypt that have suggested they, for instance, would maintain the peace with Israel, and therefore, again, this suggests that at a minimum, you're not going to see war overnight when you have democratization, and even more so that you might establish greater support for peace. You also have had the phenomena that even some opposition Egyptian politicians have claimed, you know, in public in some of their speeches, that unfortunately some of the regimes in the Middle East have kind of tried to distract their own populations from internal grievances and internal repression to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, even though there are legitimate concerns there that I myself have spent my life trying to look at. But that there has been a role for regimes to do that, and now if there is kind of real democracy and democratization, you could arguably say there's going to be less of that going on, creating healthier environment for peace to occur. You do have some politicians in Israel that are, and I'll wrap this up soon, that are saying the situation is such that you have to pursue peace even more urgently. So you have, for instance, the Defense Minister Ehud Barak saying Israel's going to face a diplomatic tsunami if it doesn't become more proactive on peace. And so in that sense, it can foster democratization. And very quickly, On the other hand, the process of democratization itself, the international relations literature suggests, doesn't necessarily foster peace, as regimes are vulnerable, as they have setbacks, as there might be appeals to greater nationalism, as you could have independent militias fostering. And so in the democratizing process, you could face challenges. And I think we've seen this perhaps, and I agree with Professor Ayoub fully, that certainly when you see freedom going across the region, you want to see freedom for Palestinians as well, and a Palestinian state established, in my mind, with a peace agreement with Israel. But what you see in the last week from Hamas is that it's repressed, first of all, demonstrations in support of democracy in Egypt. And when Abu Mazen has made gestures to come to the Gaza Strip and to have a reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas in order to kind of reconciliate the friction among them for the past 4 years, the apparent reaction has been very cautious on the part of Hamas, that they don't necessarily want Abu Mazen coming there and perhaps thousands of people demonstrating for reconciliation or demonstrating for what may be a loss in power for Hamas. And that possibly, some people argue, may have caused them, when there has been in the last 3 years relative quiet on the border, relatively speaking, to really escalate rockets. So on Saturday, there were 50 rockets going from Gaza Strip into Israel, which was a huge increase over the past couple years. And many people say that actually they're trying to escalate conflict within this environment intentionally to avoid a kind of fair democratization process in the Palestinian territories. And you have, you could argue, Iran increasing its influence in the region and in Lebanon. You could have some of these democratic transitions strengthening Hamas, which is maybe why it feels emboldened to not necessarily right now reconciliate with Fatah. And then you also have Netanyahu in Israel now, on the other end, being more cautious rather than urgently pursuing peace. He's already a very cautious person. Now even being more cautious, well, peace agreements might not be worth the paper they're written on if, you know, some in a democratization process will rip a 30-year peace agreement into pieces. That makes me even more cautious about signing a peace agreement, unfortunately, in my mind. So again, I think the democratic peace as a whole is really strong for the region as a whole when you have a lot of democracies, but the democratization process itself can be shaky in terms of peace. And I don't even have time to get into the balance of power in the region. So if you guys have any questions for that, I'd love to engage you in a discussion about that in the question period.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We certainly have an engaging panel. We could actually listen to any of them. And at the 50,000 foot level, I'm going to try to throw out some things that came across. I'd be hard-pressed to capture it all, but some of the things that really stood out in terms of how not just the academic community, but pretty much everybody missed it. No one really had a pulse on what was coming down the pike. And to think about the historical context in terms of what's the role that the military has and will play in the different uprisings that come forward, and also the extent to which transitions can be successful, how is that tied to violent versus nonviolent response by the regime, as well as the tactic that those that are activists take. So that's something else we might want to engage. And also the fact that much of what we see occurring around the world is tied to key values that we ourselves all hold to be true. And the fact of that it really is a global context. And so we may have focused on one region, but there are global issues that we need to bring into play here. And to think about the political maturity that really was at play with the activists here. There was a level of finesse and understanding that is to some degree confounding. You wouldn't necessarily expect this much of political maturity across all of these movements that was in play. And to look at the conditions that really do make us be able to deal with democratization and to go forward and to understand that there's a context behind it all. We want to open up the discussion and have you engage with each other and engage with our panelists. We are taping this, so we have a microphone that we're going to bring to you when you have a question. And now I'm sure the panel is eager to engage with you. Questions?
My question is for Dr. Alvarez. It's in correlation with what you said about the Egyptian military. To my understanding that the Egyptian military has a lot of vested interest in the economy of the Egyptian state, whereas like some of the officers controlling firms or entire markets even. I recognize that also happened in Pakistan or Musharraf. And do you believe that either the military is going to help promote democracy to keep the economy going, or do you think it's going to create like another shadow government, kind of like what we had with Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto?
I think the fact that the Egyptian military is invested in the economy, as strangely as this may sound, played a role perhaps in preventing it from becoming much more kind of like aggressive in its combating, acting against the demonstrators, because unlike in Libya, for example, as an example of a rentier state, the Egyptian economy depends also on its people and on its taxpayers, and if you declare war on the people and you have massacres, that's not very good for the. But this positive can turn into a negative if the people don't hold the military in check, because they do have a vested interest in the economy, and they want probably they would be happy of some kind of arrangement that will not challenge that interest. They were resistant. They didn't want to remove Omar Suleiman, the vice president of Mubarak, but it's the public pressure that was forced them to change it. And so, one change after another is that because the people are aware of the danger, there is also because there is so much coverage now on Egypt. Whenever there is abuse by the military, it becomes exposed to the. I think I honestly don't know the outcome. It's the activist. The way I see it, seem to be well aware of the dangers, and they are keeping the pressure on the demonstrators. But there is a history to military, militaries that have investment in the regimes don't usually, are extremely resistant to change. And Professor Ayub, if you speak, in one of the examples was Pakistan.
Yeah. I think the military will attempt to. I mean, I'm not very sanguine about Egypt. I'm more sanguine about Tunisia. I think the military is very heavily invested. It's sort of a what one can call under Mubarak, it was a form of what I like to call Praetorian corporatism. I mean, there was a Praetorian Guard, which was also very invested in the economy and controlling large segments of the economy.
And so they have that vested interest. Now, if the military top brass feels that genuine democratization is going to hurt their corporate interests beyond a certain point, you might have a backlash. In Pakistan, this has happened time and again. You referred to Pakistan. But if, on the other hand, the democracy movement and the military come to some sort of a compromise whereby there is political democracy, but the civilian leadership doesn't really attack the economic interests of the military, then you might have a transition over a long period of time. In Pakistan, it has not really taken place. I mean, it's back and forth, back and forth. But one mustn't forget that even in Turkey, it has taken over 60 years for the civilian government to be able to impose a certain amount of control over the military, and it's not full control. So it's not, it cannot be done overnight.
As a follow-up on that question, by the way, my compliments to the panel. It was extremely interesting. The institutional actor that's not been mentioned is the internal police in Egypt and other regimes as well, which probably rivaled the Stasi in the old German Democratic Republic for its extensive penetration of all sectors of the society, the universities, the media, the press, everything. To the best of my knowledge, at least the information that's leaked out, they succeeded in destroying most of their files. Very few of the internal security files have fallen into the hands of the reformers. To what extent do you think that this very, very important institutional actor, along with the party and the army that have been mentioned, will continue to play a role? Because they have been the agents of intimidation, which has sort of kept the regime in power. That's for the entire panel. Anybody wants to answer?
I don't have a great deal of knowledge on Egypt in particular, but I think what you're putting your finger on really is what I was mentioning towards the end of my discussion, which it has to do with these mechanisms of repression. The numbers of people that were shown to have been informants for the Ba'ath Party in Iraq was huge. And it really is, in many ways, like Stasi in East Germany, Savak in Iran before the fall of the Shah. The way that they're able to penetrate and really atomize the world. There was a very good book written on Syria in this regard. Lisa Wadeen from University of Chicago wrote about how, in this kind of a climate, you can produce the most absurd behaviors and statements out of your population, right? And she starts with the story of an officer who pronounced that Hafez al-Assad is so great he holds the sun in his hands, and insane, right? And she was able to trace out the power dynamics that make that possible, right? And then to talk about the question of how brittle that becomes. Once the atomization is overcome, once there's that spark that brings people together, people who are not necessarily unwilling to submit to it anymore, but who are not aware of its power in ways, can produce this cascading effect. And so I think one of the things, there was the Google executive from Egypt,
and he was on
60 Minutes. And one of the most telling statements that he made is he said, we were victorious because we didn't know anything about politics. In other words, he hadn't taken a political science class yet. No offense to the panelists. But from that position of outside the accepted wisdom, right, they were able to move this forward. And I think one of the problems that we've had getting to Professor Ayoub's statement that, we missed this, we didn't see it coming, is because we tend not to have the tools to see it coming. At least the policy relevant sciences don't have the tools, right? And not to beat up on political science too much, but they missed, the fall of Iran, the Shah, the fall of the Soviet Union, some relatively big ones, right? Because there's a certain myoptics that comes along with the way that we think of the world. So I would say, just in closing, for those of you that want to come to the anthropology department, we're looking for majors.
Did you guys predict it? I don't know. I just really quickly, I'm going to answer my dad. But I think it's going to be slower to happen, or appears to be slower to get rid of that element in Egypt, because apparently the new referendum and the calls to ending the military being able, the whole 3 decades long or so emergency rule where the military can arbitrarily arrest you with no trial or something. Apparently the changes that are being talked about are limited to that, but not necessarily the police forces, so that seems to be lagging behind. And of course in Iran the Revolutionary Guard is so entrenched. The head, one of the commanders of the Revolutionary Guard during the demonstrations called the opposition leaders dead corpses. So certainly that's a huge, additional obstacle that I think eventually will overcome, but may even lag behind the other things. And just quickly in defense of Lagarde, we do a miserable job of prediction and a greater job of explanation, but it might not be because we stupidly tried to come up with these universal theories, which I think is too ambitious. But because a lot of these things are so contingent that perhaps even anthropologists sometimes miss them, as well as political scientists.
Yeah, but let me just
and my dad is both, so I don't know what you guys.
Let me just add to that I don't think the military in Egypt was particularly upset by the Secret Service being cut down to size, because there is usually an inherent rivalry between the military and the paramilitary, as in Iran with the Revolutionary Guard, or with the Secret Services, who do the regime's dirty work. And usually, rulers like Mubarak use the Secret Services against the military itself. One, in order to balance it, and two, to keep track of what's going on, who's thing. So they might now that they can get rid of this, the old Secret Service, might try to, get all those powers in their own hands. So that's not.
I would like first to thank you for this insightful presentation. Actually, I have two questions, but before the question, just a comment. I mean, if we go back to history, I mean, history has shown us that revolutions are not an easy process. For example, I'll start by the French Revolution, where were getting rid of Louis XVI wasn't an easy process, and even after the revolution, they had Bonaparte as a dictator later on. The same thing that happened with the German also in 1848, when they revolted against the conditions, and then they had Bismarck as a dictator later on after 20 years. So in the case of Tunisia, I would like to ask you, do you think it's necessary to get rid of the old ruling party of Ben Ali? Because as far as I have been following in the couple of days, this party is not finished. They are just trying to be formed in a different way now. They are trying to be, trying to wear new costumes under a different flag, but they are the same people. And the second thing, do you think that these revolutions, they will augment, they will intensify Israel's fear from the Arabs, because now this change in regimes, they will change even the people's way of thinking, and some of the regimes they were dealing with Israel secretly, like the case in Tunisia. So how do you see the future of Arabs' relationship to Israel? Thank you.
Yeah, with your latter question first, I mean I'm also an optimistic person, but I think generally, and I've been following kind of the different news outlets in Israel every day closely, and I think there's optimistic cautiousness. So that I think as a whole, most Israelis are rooting for democratization. Because they're supportive of freedom in these countries. There are many, as I've been saying, that think that eventually this will solidify peace and mobilize eventually support for peace. But again, there's at least in the interim a lot of squeamishness and caution, and even worst case scenario preparation. So even Ehud Barak, who says, well, you have to have a diplomatic front, is saying now we have to beef up the military even more, because our whole strategic posture has been based on a 30-year peace with Egypt. And even if there's a 10% chance or 20% chance or 30% chance that that's going to fall through as democratization happens, that completely changes the scenario for military planning, military allocation to prepare for one of the big, a scenario, God forbid, where you'd be going to war with two extremely strong military. So in that sense, I think it will alter strategic planning and military planning and military allocations. But I think as a whole, people are optimistic, and one could argue in certainly a lot of the North African countries that have had pretty decent relationships with Israel, as Jordan did for years before the peace treaty, and as a lot of the Gulf states have had, as the WikiLeaks show, if some of you have been following it this semester, a lot of the Gulf states, Tzipi Livni was visiting them. They had increasing relationships with Israel, all because of the common interest of balancing Iran, which I still think is very much alive, and which is why you see the Arab world not acting monolithically, but actually various countries still very interested in balancing the possibility of increased relative power on the part of Iran in the sense. So in that sense, I think you're going to maintain the common interest in balancing Iran that has occurred. And you know, it may even increase eventually support for peace amongst the populace. But certainly, there's a lot of caution. And it's not just caution. It's going to alter completely military strategic thinking and military training and allocations. And we have war planning for China. And so Israel now is certainly going to have war planning for Egypt, unfortunately. Yeah,
I think it's the situation is much more complex. It's not an either-or thing. At one level, I mean, I don't think the Egyptian military is going to go to war with Israel.
I don't either.
I think, well, for the reasons of balance of power, for reasons that the Egyptian military is so dependent on the United States for handouts, for largesse, and you know, and the fact that the American policy sees to it that the arms given to the United to Israel are always a generation or so ahead of those given to any of its Arab rivals, and a whole host of other things. The other thing is that many of these regimes will be too preoccupied with domestic issues to change radically their foreign policy course. So they will try to keep things quiet on the foreign policy front. But that doesn't mean that the popular feeling, which has always been in the Arab world, much more anti-Israeli than the regime, than regime postures, despite regime rhetoric, has been. I think that at the popular level at some point will get reflected in democratically elected governments. In fact, that has happened in Turkey, which is not an Arab country, but there has been, I mean, the Turkish public opinion has always been much more anti-Israeli, not always, but in the last two or three decades, than the government, including the AK Party government's postures towards Israel. So that's at that level, I think you will have much more of an anti-Israeli rhetoric, pressure from the public opinion and so on and so forth. So it's going to be very much more complex. I think. And that's on the Iran issue, just very briefly. If you follow the polls in the Arab world, in the latest, the 2010 poll by the University of Maryland and the Zoghbi International, they've been doing this every year in six Arab countries, all with regimes allied to the United States, two of them in the Gulf, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. The perception of Iran amongst the public is much more benign than in the regime. The perception in is basically, I think, if you look at the overall figures, that people look when they're asked questions like, which are the countries that you see the threat, the two countries that you see threats to your country, Israel and the United States rank the highest, and Iran has like a 7-8% response which says, yes, Iran is a threat. And if you look at the popularity of leaders in the Arab world in the same polls, the two that contend for the top position are Erdogan of Turkey and Ahmadinejad of Iran. So that also gives the lie to two other myths, that there is a significant Arab-Persian divide, or that there's a significant Sunni-Shia divide. Because there, after all, Iran is able to cross that divide.
I'll just add, I agree with this, Professor. There is this tendency in the Arab autocratic regime to employ foreign service in the interest of the governing elite. Originally, you employ foreign service in the service of national interest. But in Arab regimes, foreign service is a way to support their oppressive structure. As long as they can maintain stability, that was always the one issue that you constantly hear in the media before, with respect to the health or sickness of a regime like Egypt, is their ability to be stable, to maintain a good relationship with Israel. So it even gave, the secret talk is, I think, some of the secret relationship is, and, as long as we can satisfy a national, the interest of foreign powers, we will be safe. No one will demand for democratic change. That's the thinking. So it was used somehow and also as an instrument of oppression of the people. And the people are aware of, I think, considering the polls, see that. And I think they don't like it. So movement to democracy, a movement to democracy will have to change this. Foreign policy has to respond to public opinion also. You cannot just pursue policy despite what your people are saying. And one more point. There used to be a time when the Palestinian issue was used to, as a foreign policy, as used to distract the people from domestic troubles. This has changed from, especially in the 1990s and 2001. In Egypt, the first people to be blamed, if there's terrorism attack, or is the Palestinians. And in fact, they did accuse. There was no evidence. A Palestinian group of targeting a church. No evidence for that. But it's the fear of, we need to be tough with the Palestinians. We need to support the siege of Gaza with Israel. Otherwise, the Palestinians are going to be, the Palestinians are a threat to our national security. So a movement to democracy, to openness, I think that will change the dynamic of the of the relationship.
We'd like to take one more question. Joyce gets to pick who.
Oh, I do, okay. You're closest.
It helps that I know Joyce. I have two questions. I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer them, especially the second one, because I'm gonna ask you to predict something. My first question is, while Ronim is a very intriguing, probably the most intriguing single individual out of this whole thing, because he was a rich man, basically, a very economically secure man who chose to risk a lot and to be a part of this revolution. So how do you explain him? Because I think he's very intriguing because it shows that there's a maturity over these movements, possibly. Because you can explain the poor people because they have nothing, but this guy has a lot, and he's choosing to do this because it's, to him, he sees it as just. He sees it as right. And then my second question is, I read a book, or read about a book, I haven't read the book, about the 1950s or something, the CIA coup to rid the Iranian democratically elected prime minister, and how this inspired, a lot of hatred in the Muslim world of the United States and this sort of thing. And my question is basically is, for 100 years now, not just the United States, but countries have been trying to control other countries, and it never works. It always ends up in violence and oppression and suffering and this sort of thing. Do you think that we're going to learn now, finally, from all this, the United States maybe stop trying to control Central America, stop trying to control other nations around the world? Will we stop that? And that's it.
I'll just very quickly give a response, and then to give time for other responses. I think certainly there's room for evaluating U.S. foreign policies and to what extent we've impeded democratization in the past in Egypt, and to what extent we could have done a better job. However, I would, put out a question in return, as if can you ever eliminate both internal and external influences, right? So it's not only the U.S. that is influencing things. It's Iran that's trying to expand its influence. It's Saudi Arabia that has its sphere of influence. It's Iran that's also meddling in countries in Lebanon and elsewhere. Previously, it's also been Russia that has been an actor in the region. So arguably, one could say that even if you argue that America could do a better job, and it can, and we should consider how to improve our foreign policy, that if the U.S. completely stepped back, who would fill the power vacuum? And you're always going to have, I would argue, a competition over spheres of influence. You won't be able to escape it. And some of the other actors that are trying to increase their influence may not have a more benevolent influence on the region either. But that would just be my quick response.
Yeah, if you look at the Marxist revolutions, there used to be a saying that they're always led by people who are traitors to their class. It's not the peasants and the the disorganized labor that take the lead. It's the middle class. So in some ways, the Bayl Ghanim phenomenon could be an extension of that. Although the revolution, if you want to call it that, in Egypt was still very much a middle class phenomenon. So he also belonged to the class. It wasn't a Bolshevik or a Maoist revolution. So it really came, the leadership came from that class, and it saw its genuine interests being harmed by the regime, by crony capitalism, and so on and so forth. So that's one. Yes, the Mossadegh, I'm glad you brought up the 1953 CIA coup, which overthrew Mossadegh. Some people have argued that 1979, the Iranian revolution of 1979, was a delayed reaction to 1953. To the overthrow of Mossadegh, and therefore you see that the anti-American edge and the Shah portrayed as the American Shah. I mean, that was one of the major slogans during the revolution, was down with the American Shah. So there are consequences that there are delayed returns for what you do in certain parts of the world.
Do you want?
Just quickly responding to the issue of foreign intervention. While in the past some of our interventions may not have been things that we may be proud of, I think that in the current case there is a lot that we can do and that other governments can do in terms of helping develop civil society, helping bring people who have experience with building party systems, building economies to the region in order to share their experiences. I know that I've been reading in Egypt and Tunisia, you have people who were involved in Central America and other in these movements and other in other revolutions coming in to offer advice. I think advice is something that can be used in these countries to help further the transitions. And that's perhaps a kind of foreign intervention that we shouldn't be immediately dismissive of.
I have a slightly different take. When we talk in terms of states, we talk in terms of countries, we talk in terms of their spheres of influence, their national interests. We have a very sort of realist understanding of how the world works. But one of the things that really becomes clear when you're talking about the post-colonial world and talking about it from a much lower level, right? A lower scale, if you will, is the degree to which the countryness of post-colonial countries has never been respected, right? The countries of the Middle East were born of colonialism. Their borders were written for them by men like Churchill. Their leaders have been chosen for them, and those leaders who have come up that we haven't liked so much have met unfortunate ends, right? And that lesson has been learned by the elites of these countries, right? Each one of them, if you take the case of Lebanon, for example, everybody says, Lebanon, oh, Hezbollah is a state within a state. Isn't that horrible? Well, no, Hezbollah is playing the Lebanese political system the way the Lebanese political system was set up, such that each oligarchic slash sectarian entity, the Maronites, the Sunnis, the Catholics, the Druze, have their own strongman. That strongman is supported by one or more external powers, right? These countries are shot through with political and economic networks, right? Not state-to-state relations as such. And that's one of the things that you know, these WikiLeaks releases are starting to show in many ways. And I wish they'd hurry the hell up and get us some more documents out there. But we're seeing the degree to which you have, in the Middle East, I think, the development of really a regional oligarchy, right? If you look at the leadership from Lebanon, for example, and look at what they're investing in, who they're investing with, right? These are they're investing, say, Hariri, the Hariri family, a Saudi Lebanese billionaire businessman who becomes prime minister. Where's the divide between the state and the economy there? I don't know. He's investing in projects in Egypt with the generals to develop the shopping malls that the generals protected during the uprising when they should have been protecting the National Museum, but they put the military out to protect the shopping malls. Did you guys notice that? He's investing with the Jordanian royal family in property developments all over Jordan, right? You look at the Gulf elites, the royal families, who are also the defense minister, the interior minister, the et cetera, they're investing in investment funds with Israelis, right? With the Israeli oligarchs who are increasingly tearing Israel apart. So you see a consolidation across national lines that has a great deal to do with what can and cannot happen in the Middle East. And those need to be paid attention to, not least because the power that they have, but that the people of the region are deeply cognizant of it, right? One of the most amazing experiences I've had in Lebanon is just riding with a cab driver, and he can tell you who owns every building in the shopping district of Verdun. Which family owns this, which family owns this, which family owns this, which family owns this. The World Bank guys that were analyzing the Lebanese real estate market, they had no idea, right? They were very excited to have me show up because they found somebody who could explain to them what's going on in the real estate market. But I couldn't explain to them anything more than the average Lebanese had in his own head, right? So these are very important political markers and political connections that cut across boundaries and have very powerful influences over what is possible and what is not possible in terms of the geopolitics of the Middle East, in fact. Right, so we need to be thinking about it not just in terms of these sort of realist assumptions, but we need to be looking at, in more nuanced ways, I think, at the deep interconnections that have linked different regimes, different power structures, and made for some very, very strange bedfellows in the course of history. And I think there you will find some very interesting explanations. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, the questions are very intriguing. When I looked around the room, I saw many more hands than we would have the opportunity to field. One of the things that I want to do is make sure we create space that you can still talk with the panelists individually and talk amongst yourselves. So I would ask at this time if we would just take a moment and thank the panel for just their incredible insight. And I'm going to ask you not to leave, but rather to engage in informal conversations and to encourage you to keep the conversations going beyond today. Thank you very much.